Welcome to Gender Studies. That's not the name of our podcast.
It's back to school.
Okay, let's try that one again. Welcome to Gender Troubles. I'm Emma.
I'm Eva.
And we majored in gender studies, so you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing today, Eva?
Good. Do I sound any different?
You sound clear and warm and
dulcet tones. I got a real microphone. So,
well,
that was hopefully that makes everyone's listening experience a little bit better. And now my vocal fry will just be my vocal fry. It won't be like tinny vocal fry.
Love a good vocal fry.
More authentic.
I'm still using.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm still using my partner's gaming headset that lights up if I plug in the USB part, but I'm not going to.
Are you in a gaming chair?
I wish. No, I won't let him get a gaming chair because they're hideous.
Fair enough.
He also wanted to get the like zoomer lights, you know, that go around.
I don't understand.
No, I don't want my house to be an arcade. I want
it's like a party
vibes.
Bus. Yeah. I once got an Uber home from work because I had to clock out early because I was like super nauseous and throwing up. And the Uber that picked me up was a party Uber. Mm-hmm. And so I was sitting in the back, kind of like rocking back and forth, trying not to throw up everywhere. And there were all these like lights and like weird early 2000s techno happening. And it was a very jarring experience. So I get a little bit of PTSD whenever I see those kind of like flashy blinky lights.
I think there's a time and place for it. And if I was taking an Uber to the club, perhaps I would appreciate that. But most of the time, no, I just want a calm, nice ride. Maybe some fresh air, some light jazz in the background.
Yeah, a water bottle, just the basics. Yeah,
just the basics. So today we're going to talk about radical feminism.
Yes, I'm excited for this.
Yes. I know you mentioned in the liberal feminism episode that was, you skipped a lot of that in our education.
Yes.
Did you get more radical feminism?
I mean, yes, but not really willingly.
Yes.
I think sometimes radical feminist ideas were presented by our professors as if they were not radical at all and mm-hmm. kind of the norm. Mm-hmm. So doing more research and learning like, oh, not all feminists during this time were this extreme and sometimes this exclusionary was definitely helpful.
Yeah. If you haven't listened to the liberal feminism episode, I would go check that out. It's our first episode. And as we'll discuss, radical feminism very much emerged in response to liberal feminism. So it would be a helpful one to check out first.
Mm-hmm.
As was the case with our liberal feminism episode, radical feminism is a huge school of thought spanning multiple decades and full of diverging beliefs. So this will be kind of a general overview. I'm going to speak about the history and methods of radical feminism and subgenres of radical feminism like SWERFs and TERFs and some critiques of radical feminism. And each one of these subpoints could have their own episode. So this is like, yeah, it's a really big topic, but I will, as always, include a reading list. So if you're super interested, you can take a deeper dive into the subject. So as we discussed in liberal feminism episode, it relied heavily on using power structures already in place to elevate the status of women, like legal and educational institutions. Mm-hmm. And radical feminism took a very different approach. So first, what is the etymology of radical? The word radical is from the Latin radix, which means to pull from the root, which I found very cool.
So to like...
Yeah, to grasp at the root.
To grasp it and pull it out, being like, we don't want this thing anymore. Oh!
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily negative, like we don't want this thing anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe it could be like... you know, like you grasp a carrot at the root because that's the part you're going to eat. But it just really just means to grasp at the root. To
pull okay.
From the root, yeah.
In a non-sexual way either.
Yes. Well, maybe. So radical feminism was very much concerned with the root. The root was the oppression of women by patriarchal forces. That was the root of oppression. So this is a quote from Kathy Sarah Child from 1973. Before we go any further, let's examine the word radical. It is a word that is often used to suggest extremist, but actually it doesn't mean that. The dictionary says radical means root, coming from the Latin word for root. And that is what we meant by calling ourselves radicals. We were interested in getting to the roots of problems in society. You might say we wanted to pull up the weeds in the garden by their roots, not just pick off the leaves at the top to make things look good momentarily. Women's liberation was started by women who considered themselves radicals in this sense.
Okay.
Yeah. So radical feminists really rejected the more liberal feminist approach of, as Audre Lorde would say, using the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. So yeah, they advocated for, simply put, a radical dismantling. And while liberal feminists tend to work by integrating women into mainstream society and advocating for a position for them within that society, a radical feminist stance was focused on transforming the patriarchal core of society. So yeah, radical feminism emerged in the 1960s alongside the civil rights movement and the gay liberation movement as an emancipatory movement that saw male domination of women as the central and oldest paradigm of domination in society. So a popular way of sort of building momentum within the radical feminist movement was consciousness raising groups. So this was one way that radical feminists disseminated their information. This is another quote from Kathy Sarah Child. The roots of problems in society were to be analyzed in consciousness-raising groups, small women-only settings where women discussed the political dimension of their multifaceted experiences, covering a wide range of topics from early childhood to work, relationships with men, and feelings about one's body. These groups popped up all over the United States and Canada in the 60s and 70s as a way for women to understand their own experience and raise their consciousness about women's issues. And it also served as a space for organizing demonstrations and actions. Again, Sarah Child described consciousness-raising groups as the following, quote, "The decision to emphasize our own feelings and experiences as women and to test all generalizations and reading we did by our own experience was actually the scientific method of research. We were in effect repeating the 17th century challenge of science to scholasticism. Study nature, not books, and put all theories to the test of living practice and action. It was also a method of radical organizing tested by other revolutions. We were applying to women and to ourselves as women's liberation organizers the practice a number of us had learned as organizers in the civil rights movement in the South in the early 1960s. Consciousness raising, studying the whole gamut of women's lives, starting with the full reality of one's own, would also be a way of keeping the movement radical by preventing it from getting sidetracked into single issue reforms and single issue organizing. It would be a way of carrying theory about women further than it had ever been carried before, as the groundwork for achieving a radical solution for women has yet attained nowhere." Yeah. So I liked that quote, but also, I feel like, I mean, we'll get to this in a bit, but one of the sort of critiques of radical feminism was that the belief was that, patriarchy was at the root of oppression. And so it tended to, there was a lot of critique from a third wave feminist stance that that was including intersectionality and the experience of race in the lives of women. That was kind of missing from radical feminism because many radical feminists felt, white radical feminists felt that it was kind of a distraction to include race in the radical feminist fight. Like we needed to focus on patriarchy. So yeah, we'll talk about that a bit later, but I think that that kind of sentiment is a bit present in that quote. But I did like how she talked about that this was like sort of a scientific method of doing research, like women getting together and like talking about their experiences and their like the oppression that they faced, and sort of figuring out solutions to it.
Yeah, that reminds me of, I don't have the quote, but when Betty Friedan writes in The Feminine Mystique about how like the figure of the housewife is so kind of isolated. And that is kind of the genius of this patriarchal oppression of the housewife, is like, she may not even know that she is as oppressed as she is, because she doesn't really have the space or the options to really form community with other housewives and begin to kind of suss out what's going on. So it seems as if part of this quote is trying to just kind of illustrate to like the importance of like being able to have dialogue in a community. And one of the easiest ways to kind of squash any form of political action and change is to just kind of break apart and isolate people. Sure. That's not to say, though, that, you know, bringing race or class into these discussions would be doing that. That seems more of just white radical women having feelings and opinions.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think, why, because this, like, it was like a pretty controversial thing when it came about, these consciousness music groups, and they were like largely dismissed as apolitical venting sessions by major political parties across the board, and were popularly referred to as therapy sessions by policymakers. They were seen as a time to complain about personal issues and just like, oh, these silly women getting together, you know, talking about women's stuff. And so, and I think that that came out of like just like likely a general fear. And you know, it just hadn't really happened necessarily before, so it was unsettling, I think. And this is when the old feminist adage, the personal is political, was popularized. So while no one has claimed authorship of this phrase, it was mentioned in Carol Haneisch's 1969 essay, The Personal is Political, where she speaks about the dismissing of consciousness-raising groups as therapy groups. And she says, quote, "So the reason I participate in these meetings is not to solve any personal problem. One of the first things we discover in these groups is that personal problems are political problems. There are no personal solutions at this time. There is only collective action for a collective solution." And yeah, so what Haneisch is saying is that what was largely being dismissed as personal problems by mainstream society were also political problems. So common agenda items at consciousness-raising groups included access to abortion and reproductive rights, free daycare, birth control, and sexual harassment law. So yeah, they were personal issues, but they're also political. And yeah, radical feminism relied heavily on collective action versus individual action, which was also fostered in these consciousness-raising groups. Radical feminists really kind of paved the way for a lot of legal action and activism around things like abortion. Groups like the Red Stockings formed in the 1960s in New York and had a very public stance on women's rights to abortion access. They would organize demonstrations and famously stormed a hearing of the New York State Joint Legislative Committee on Public Health, which was in the middle of discussing abortion law reform with about 10 men and one woman who was a nun.
The most qualified group of people ever.
Absolutely.
To discuss abortion.
So radical feminists were also really concerned with things like sexual violence and workplace harassment, and worked to organize demonstrations to raise awareness and influence policy around these issues. So let's talk about SWRFs.
It's wonderful.
So many radical feminists believed that sex work was another aspect of society that patriarchy was at the root of, and thus it must be uprooted. Well-known radical feminist Kathleen Barry wrote a lot about this subject. Very interesting reading. And she has titles including The Underground Economic System of Pimping, and Female Sexual Slavery, Understanding the International Dimensions of Women's Oppression. So I totally get that there is sex work out there, and maybe there was even more so when these texts were written in the 80s, where sex workers do not have control, and it can be coercive and it can be violent, just like most other industries.
Yeah.
However, the sex work abolitionist approach really only worked to further push sex workers to the margins of society. So that was how the term SWRF came about, or it's an acronym for Sex Worker Exclusionary Radical Feminist, because if your feminism advocates for the illegalization and abolition of sex work, It harms sex workers and excludes them from your fight for rights.
Mm.
So what happens when we advocate for sex workers' rights? We have regulation, we have minimum wages, safe locations, resources, etc. And that is a topic for another episode. Some radical feminists wrote a lot about the eradication of sex work and pushed a lot of policy forward. They used the word prostitution, and more so they used the word prostituted to emphasize that this was something men did to women. So the bottom line for SWERFs was prostitution was not compatible with women's rights. It was a patriarchal institution that benefited men and harmed women. And that was that.
This SWERFs are something that I feel like a lot of women from our mother's generation, I know a lot of women from my mother's generation who still really hold on to this kind of ethos, even in not so much of like a outspoken way, but just a general understanding that like sex work is inherently exploitative because, you know, it's just men exploiting women. And then you bring up like, well, what about queer sex workers? Or any beginning to chip away at this kind of man dominating woman, which is typically really coded as like white woman being subjected to harm.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw then liberal feminism, right? Oh, yeah. Where so much of it was like, where it's like white female slavery and all of that kind of stuff. Like people will really easily just kind of dismiss any sort of, well, you know, the queer sex workers are still also oppressed and just don't realize it yet or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really funny because in this second article I mentioned by Kathleen Berry, which was written in the 80s, she makes that connection between white slave traffic, which is what we talked about in liberal feminism, but she doesn't mention the like race part of it, that like that was like a fear of like white women being like, you know, coerced into sexual slavery largely by men of color, and that it was like there was just like a huge racist undertone to that fear. She doesn't like make that connection. She's just like, this has been happening for years, and feminists have been talking about it for years, first with white slave traffic and now, you know, with sexual slavery. And it's funny, but yeah, no, I've definitely had those kind of talks with like women from my mother's generation as well, and like trying to get to the bottom of it. And they're often like, you know, oh, it's just so personal. It's so intimate. Mm-hmm. How could you do that with someone? And it's like, you know, try like being a nanny and holding a person's baby every day is personal and intimate in a different way, obviously, but it's still like, you're so involved in these people's lives, and like, and it's really emotional and you really like involved. And I don't know. I think that it's kind of like a cop out to be like, oh, it's too intimate.
or like it's degrading. And it's like, I've had many jobs that I would consider degrading, none of which were sex
working
work.
In the service industry.
Yes. and I don't know. I think another thing that kind of makes people feel kind of like clutch their pearls when talking about sex work is just kind of this Puritan like inherent sacredness to sex that is again fitting into a very kind of like neat heteronormative narrative of when we think about like sex is a union between two, you know, a man and a woman or whatever. And those kind of, especially in North America, it's like really hard to break out of those like deeply ingrained kind of ideas around like what sex is supposed to signify.
Yeah.
And if you are, you know, offering a service that involves sexual activity as a sex worker, like that's somehow like ruining or tainting the sacredness of sex, which just isn't how any of that works, and doesn't account for so many people, you know, having sex that means very different things, sacred or not.
For sure. Yeah. And I think, I mean, you can only really argue that sex work is degrading if you think that sex is somehow like shameful and, you know, I think it's important to work towards a vision of society where sex isn't shameful and it's not in the shadow, because then maybe we can all have a bit of a healthier conception of sex, and we can talk about things like consent more actively with young people, and you know, just like get away with that you know, sex shame stuff. It's not working for any of us.
My father has now really embraced that sex work is real work, and he likes to bring it up often to people.
I love that.
so he'll be having a conversation and be like, my daughter is getting a gender studies degree, and they'll just go, sex work is real work.
Just has this little chant. I love
that. Yeah, it's like, we love that. Okay. Yeah. People have the capacity to grow and change. And, you know, if my father can get behind understanding sex work as being work, then surely other people can too.
Yeah. I have a relative that lives in Washington State, and in Washington State, they have, these topless coffee shops, and they're like often drive through. They're like these little huts, and the baristas are topless. There are some members in my family that are just like, oh, it's, you know, it's totally just exploitative and degrading. And I think it's impressive if you get through a day without burning your boobies.
That's my question. Like, I'm all for topless work, but like the amount I spill on myself. Yeah. And, oh God. Especially if you were more ample chested, like what if something gets in the milk frother or something?
I know.
God,
that's what I think about. For me. It's just like, that's a workplace hazard. But all the power to you if you have the skills to do it. So based on that description of SWRFs, can you tell us what a TERF is?
Well, I'm going to guess it includes exclusionary radical feminist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because I know the answer to this riddle, I was going to say a TERF is a trans exclusionary radical feminist.
That's right. Yeah. So according to author Roz Cavani, TERF was actually a term adopted by radical feminists to differentiate themselves from their peers who excluded trans women from their feminism, which I didn't know. So
it was used as a way to differentiate, like, they are TERFs.
Yeah.
We are radical feminists, but we are trans inclusionary.
Yeah, we're TERFs.
Tires.
we're just radical feminists.
We're just feminists.
we're ERFs and they're TERFs. Yeah.
Okay. Love that.
Yeah. I thought it was neat. So the base of the TERF ideology is summed up by Cavani. She writes, quote, accordingly, they, TERFs, think the existence of trans people is a delusion perpetuated as a new mode of oppression. Trans women exist in order to give the idea of gender plausibility and to divide women's community by entering it. Something TERF theorist Janice Raymond compared to rape in her 1979 book, The Transsexual Empire. Yeah, it's pretty gnarly. So in a nutshell, some radical feminists saw the inclusion of trans people into the feminist mission as a direct threat, as though this was going to inhibit their fight. And this is a type of feminism that has become extremely virulent in the last decade, like J.K. Rowling, especially in the perceiving of gender as on a spectrum and how that has like entered more mainstream thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like this quote by Jacobin. For many radical feminists, it doesn't matter what gender someone identifies and presents as. It only matters what gender they are assigned at birth. If men are the oppressors and the source of women's oppression, it follows that those men maintain that oppressive power even after they transition. Their socialization as men, no matter how short-lived or plagued by gender dysphoria and violence, renders them agents of female oppression. Thus, many radical feminists ban trans people, and particularly trans women, from their politics and organizing spaces. This exclusion isn't just bigoted, it's hypocritical. While radical feminists campaign vigorously against sexual violence, it's trans women who suffer from disproportionately high rates of sexual and physical violence, particularly trans women of color.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm rarely at a loss for words, but when trying to just do the Jedi mind tricks around TERF's conceptualizations of oppression and womanhood and all of that, it's just... Yeah, it's we. I'm in Burlington, Vermont right now, and in my city district, the Republican who's running for city council, the election's today,
Oh,
I'll keep you
nice.
updated, is a gay man who has been tw has tweeted some very transphobic things before, and has been really kind of deflecting criticism behind his gayness, as if that somehow like gives him more of an authority to like dictate stuff around gender and sexual identity. And I feel like that's very similar to these like turfy women, especially in this time of just this gatekeeping of what it means to be oppressed. And once again, a lot of these motherfuckers were white women. And it's like you can't talk about like a male dominating women and not take into account all of these other systems of oppression.
I know.
Ugh.
It's so like just have the blinders on, like reducing feminism to like just this like stupid idea. Yeah.
And where do intersex people fit in too? Like all of these
Know.
people who are like J.K. Rowling, who like bases all of their critique in like supposed like biology and whatnot. And it's like again, there's so many intersex people who, suffer severe, medical harm because their parents a lot of the time are forced to choose a gender for their child. And it's like where they must not be included then.
Yeah,
It's
exactly.
very when you try to break down gender into like sex organs and chromosomes and biology, like it doesn't work.
Yeah, and it absolutely totally falls apart when you consider the reality of intersex people. We should probably do like a whole episode on that because I think
Definitely,
we probably
definitely.
have some good resources for that as well. I can think of a couple articles that really like I remember in like my first year of gender studies, like I was just a little baby, you know. I understood that like gender was on a spectrum, but I don't think I really realized that sex is like genitals are also on a spectrum. And that like I feel like once you kind of like that kind of comes into your frame too, it's like it's much easier to conceive of gender on a spectrum, even more so than it was to begin with.
So give me the critiques of these people, please.
Yes. We're gonna go back to a little Kimberly Crenshaw because we love her.
We do.
Because radical feminists believe that patriarchy was the central oppressive force in the world, the unique experience of women of color was often glazed over. In 1991, Kimberly Crenshaw wrote about the past failings of the feminist movement, cue beginning of the third wave. And in her article, Mapping the Margins, Intersectionality, Identity, Politics, and Violence Against Women of Color, she discusses how second wave radical feminist movement had often occluded the unique experience of Black women because it was seen as distracting from the central issue, which was patriarchy. So all women suffered under patriarchy, and that was that. So this is kind of a long quote, but I'm going to read it because it's good. The problem with identity politics is not that it fails to transcend difference, as some critics charge, but rather the opposite, that it frequently conflates or ignores intragroup difference. In the context of violence against women, this elision of difference in identity politics is problematic, fundamentally because the violence that many women experience is often shaped by other dimensions of their identities, such as race and class. Moreover, ignoring difference within groups can contributes to tension among groups, another problem of identity politics that bears on efforts to politicize violence against women. Feminist efforts to politicize experiences of women and anti-racist efforts to politicize experiences of people of color have frequently proceeded as though the issues and experience they each detail occur on mutually exclusive terrains. Although racism and sexism readily intersect in the lives of real people, they seldom do in feminist and anti-racist practices. And so, when the practices expound identity as woman or person of color as an either-or proposition, they relegate the identity of women of color to a location that resists telling. I really like that.
I love that.
She was kind of talking about how, like, the like anti-racist movement during, you know, this time period that we're talking about, 60s, 70s, often didn't include the unique experience of Black women.
Mm-hmm.
And then the feminist movement that we're kind of talking about, the second wave radical movement, talked about the experience of women without it, again, talking about the unique experience of Black women, and thus like sort of rendering their experience invisible. So I think that is kind of, I mean, that is where the third wave was born, and this idea of intersectionality and intersecting experiences and coming from multiple positions of oppression.
And I love that you're ending with her, because I am going to do next episode about intersectionality.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's awesome.
And
I didn't
kind
even
of
plan it.
I know. It's just,
we're just connected.
Galaxy brain. So how do you want to leave off? Any final thoughts for Radical Feminism 101?
No, I don't think so. I'm going to include a bunch of readings in the reading list. Some of them I'm going to put a little trigger warning beside because I have included some readings from a TERF that I quoted.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that not everyone wants to read that, and that's okay. I didn't like reading it. And I mean, I'm going to put my source in because I read one of their quotes, but yeah.
And if you've made it all the way to the end of this episode, you get a little special treasure, where we have some very exciting news regarding us and the podcast and our future, and we are not able to reveal it yet, but we will really soon. And so thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Also, one
yes.
more fun thing. We are now on Patreon.
We are on Patreon.
Which I've never used before, but I understand that people can potentially pay us.
Yes. And we can give them special extra things.
Yes.
So early days on that, but we are on Patreon. It is in the link tree if you go
yes.
to our Instagram bio.
Yeah. So on Instagram, we're gender.troubles.pod. And our Patreon is www.patreon.com/gender_troubles. We're planning on doing some like special kind of fun, more like culture critique episodes, like doing some movie reviews and maybe some book reviews and stuff like that. So, if you want to, you know, give us a little money on Patreon, you can have access to those things.
Please give us money.
Please. So we'll see you next week. Eva will be talking about intersectionality. And until then, I'll see you later.
See you later.